build this World Cup that started in 2010. Those Qatari companies, and remember, migrant workers had no basic human rights, those Qatari companies were competing against each other for the lowest cost. I think every country can do a better job of respecting the rights of migrant workers, but we've never before seen such a concentration of construction. And to be clear, this is at least $220 billion of construction. So it's 8 new stadiums where they previously didn't exist in the desert. It's hundreds of miles of railways, highways, hundreds of new hotels, office towers springing up. So the construction was unprecedented for this World Cup. You can broadly call it infrastructure. And the situation for migrant workers was that they really were desperate to earn money, and once they were there, had no, in some cases, we documented families, the workers begged the sponsors to send them home.
Minky Worden, we want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we're going to continue to cover this story. Minky Worden is Director of Global Initiatives at Human Rights Watch. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Sharif Abdelkadous, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, Nermeen Sheikh here in Cairo, our whole team in New York. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Are you a fan of early rock and roll, doo-wop, rhythm and blues, and 70s rock? If so, The Roots of Rock and Roll is the show for you, and KBOO Portland is the place to be Friday afternoons at 3. Dale Farr will give you a history lesson from the birth of rock and roll through the 50s and 60s. And Ray Bodwell will mine the 60s and 70s for the deep cuts, hidden gems, and variety that you won't hear on generic classic rock stations. So tune in to The Roots of Rock and Roll, Fridays at 3 p.m. on KBOO Portland, your community radio station.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Governor Kate Brown pardons 45,000 for marijuana possession. 5 are dead and over 20 injured in a mass shooting in a gay club in Colorado Springs. And Oregon's new gun law, Measure 114, faces its first legal challenge. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 21st, 2022. I'm Michelle Coppola. Oregon Governor Kate Brown has pardoned over 45,000 Oregonians who were convicted on marijuana charges. That's according to a press release from the governor's office today. The pardon will remove more than 47,000 convictions of possession of an ounce or less of marijuana, specifically for cases prior to 2016 where the person was 21 or older. The pardon also includes forgiveness for more than $14 million in fines and fees. Prior convictions can pose a problem for folks when they try to get a job, housing, or education. This blanket pardon means that 45,000 people convicted of marijuana possession will no longer have that on their record. Brown said in a statement, quote, "No one deserves to be forever saddled with the impact of a conviction for simple possession of marijuana, a crime that is no longer on the books in Oregon." Oregonians should never face housing insecurity, employment barriers, and educational obstacles as a result of doing something that is now completely legal and has been for years. She also noted that while Oregonians use marijuana at similar rates across racial groups, Black and Latina people have been disproportionately impacted. Brown continued, quote, "We are a state and a nation of second chances. Today, I'm taking steps to right the wrongs of a flawed, inequitable, and outdated criminal justice system in Oregon when it comes to personal marijuana possession. For the estimated 45,000 individuals who are receiving a pardon for prior state convictions of marijuana possession, this action will help relieve the collateral consequences arriving from those convictions," end quote. The pardon doesn't apply to other offenses related to marijuana and other controlled substances. Brown's office promises that the state Justice Department will seal court records from the pardoned offenses within the next month. The pardoned offense won't show up on background checks or searches of public court records, but could show up as a pardoned offense for background checks done by law enforcement. Governor Brown's action comes a little over a month after President Biden pardoned federal-level marijuana possession offenses and called on state governors to do the same. At a time when many families are gathering to celebrate the holidays, communities across Colorado are mourning the killing of five people in a mass shooting at an LGBTQ nightclub in Colorado Springs late Saturday night. Eric Galatis has more.
Communities across Colorado continue to mourn the death of at least five people after a 22-year-old gunman allegedly opened fire inside an LGBTQ nightclub in Colorado Springs on Saturday. More than two dozen people were injured. District Attorney Michael Allen told reporters he has a strong interest in prosecuting the case, including as a possible hate crime, because it's important for the community to see that the perpetrator is held accountable.
The current bias-motivated crime statute in the state of Colorado provides some elevation, but will not elevate beyond what will likely be charges in this case, which will likely include first-degree murder, extreme indifference murder, those types of charges, which are all Class 1 felony murder charges.
Allen says everyone charged with crimes is presumed to be innocent until proved guilty. In a statement, Colorado Governor Jared Polis said, "My heart breaks for the family and friends of those lost, injured, and traumatized in this horrific shooting." He also told Colorado Springs Mayor John Suthers that he would make every state resource available to local law enforcement. The mass shooting at Club Q occurred on the eve of Transgender Day of Remembrance, which honors the memory of those murdered in acts of anti-transgender violence. Allen also said that every person, regardless of who they are, has the right to be secure from fear and physical harm.
"And actions taken to strike fear in specific communities will not be tolerated in our community. This is particularly true for communities that have been maligned, harassed, and targeted by persons or groups to intimidate and cause harm to members of those communities."
According to data collected by Human Rights Campaign, before Saturday's shooting, at least 32 transgender and gender nonconforming people have been killed in 2022, although actual numbers are likely much higher due to underreporting. Victims are overwhelmingly Black, under 35, and killed with a firearm. More than 16% of transgender students reported being physically assaulted, while one in three has experienced physical harassment. This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Basic Rights Oregon is a statewide advocacy organization for LGBTQ2SIA Oregonians. Following the mass shooting at Club Q in Colorado Springs, Interim Executive Director Todd Adams made a statement. Adams said, quote, "Each of the five people killed last night had loved ones, dreams for their futures, and a community they cared about. While we don't yet know the motivations of the shooter, we do know that LGBTQ2SIA plus spaces like Club Q play a uniquely affirming and irreplaceable role in many of our lives." He continued, quote, "Any attack on such a space is devastating for our community and sends a stark reminder that our society continues to be plagued by hatred, ignorance, and gun violence. We are sending love and support to Colorado's LGBTQ2SIA plus community," end quote. Basic Rights Oregon also encourages folks to seek out resources if they're experiencing mental health difficulties as a result of the news. They highlight the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's LGBTQ crisis and support resources that are online at afsp.org. The Oregon Firearms Federation is suing the state over Measure 114. A federal lawsuit was filed late Friday in Oregon's U.S. District Court, listing Governor Kate Brown and Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum as defendants. Measure 114 passed earlier this month. It requires Oregonians to get a permit to buy a new gun and prohibits the sale, possession, and use of magazines that can hold more than 10 rounds. The new rules are set to go into effect on December 8th. The lawsuit claims the measure violates the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution as well as the state constitution. It primarily takes issue with the ban on high-capacity magazines. The legal complaint reads, quote, "The reason for the popularity of these magazines is that in a confrontation with a violent attacker, having enough ammunition can be the difference between life and death," end of quote. It also says the measure impedes hunting, recreational shooting, and competitive marksmanship. The lawsuit calls on the federal court to declare the measure unconstitutional and to immediately issue an injunction to stop enforcement. Alternatively, the plaintiffs at least want the judge to hold enforcement of the section banning magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Measure 114 is one of the strictest state gun laws in the country. It passed with 50.7% of the statewide vote. Oregonians who already own guns don't need to obtain a permit unless they plan on buying a new firearm. Small Business Saturday is this weekend, a follow-up to Black Friday that celebrates locally owned businesses on the busiest shopping weekend of the year. Eric Tegedoff has more with the head of the Hillsboro Downtown Partnership.
Once the turkey feast is over, the shopping season for Christmas begins in earnest. But there's an alternative to Black Friday this weekend, Small Business Saturday. For more than a decade, the day has marked a way for small businesses to push back against large corporations, which take up a significant slice of sales on the busiest shopping weekend of the year. Alisa Joy Payne is head of the Hillsboro Downtown Partnership.
Sometimes you remember the situation or the place where you purchased the gift more than you actually remember the gift that you bought for somebody. And what better place to do that than in a cute little store on Main Street or the avenues, and to have that memory versus fighting the hordes of people at the malls or box stores.
Payne says there is also Plaid Friday in place of Black Friday, in which people are encouraged to wear plaid to show their support for small and locally owned businesses. Payne says Hillsboro has experienced hardships this year. At the beginning of the year, a downtown fire damaged more than 20 businesses and killed one person. She says businesses are still recovering from the fire, on top of the years of the pandemic. But Payne adds that people still open small businesses because their heart is in it.
That's what a small business is it somebody's individual passion that they want to share with their community or their world. And this is the opportunity for them to really showcase that.
There are more than 32 million small businesses in the U.S. Small Business Saturday was created and is promoted by American Express. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
An Oregon institution, Alpen Rose Dairy, will move from its longtime Southwest Portland home to Clackamas after purchasing Larson's Creamery. Alpen Rose has been in business for over a century and was bought in 2019 by the Washington-based Smith Brothers Farm. However, the Smith Brothers didn't purchase the property on Southwest Shattuck Road, where Alpen Rose is currently located. Now that Alpen Rose will move to combine with Larson's, another longtime area business, developers are salivating over the opportunity to build on the old dairy property. It's 51 acres, and in early development meetings with city officials, a housing subdivision has been proposed. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. At 7, let's talk about race. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with an overnight low of 37. Tomorrow, it looks like our dry streak is ending. Rain and a daytime high of 51. Today in history, in 1898, Belgian surrealist artist René Magritte was born. Magritte is known for creating witty and thought-provoking images, often depicting ordinary objects in an unusual context. The quote of the day is from Magritte, who said, quote, "If the dream is a translation of waking life is also a translation of the dream." The Grand Portage Bay Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are celebrating a historic return of land to tribal control in Minnesota. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. For the first time in history of the state of Minnesota, off-reservation land has been returned to tribal hands. As Barbara Jean Myers reports, a ceremony to celebrate the land return took place last week.
The returned land, a stretch of beach along Lake Superior's north shore outside Grand Marais, Minnesota, was once part of a larger Native settlement known as Chippewa City. The historic occasion was celebrated with a ceremony at the Grand Portage Lodge and Casino. John Morin, a Grand Portage tribal elder, was one of the keynote speakers.
I heard many stories from my mother and my aunts and uncles about growing up in Chippewa City and growing up and walking on that and running and playing on the beach that we've now gotten back. So it's a very personal day for me and a very historical day for the state of Minnesota, Cook County, and the Grand Portage homeland.
The celebration was also very personal for area historian, author, and Grand Portage tribal descendant Stacy Droulard. Like John Morin, Chippewa City was home to many of Droulard's ancestors.
Nishkwakwansing is the Ojibwe name, which means the edge of the forest or where the trees stand, which is a very, I think, beautiful name for the place.
Droulard's book, Walking the Old Road, A People's History of Chippewa City and the Grand Marais Anishinaabe, helped raise awareness in the broader public about the significance of the area. Bobby Deschamps is the Grand Portage Tribal Council chairman.
To end 2022 like this for Indian country is just unbelievable. Net Lake got 27,000 acres back.
Oh.
Fond du Lac got Wisconsin Point back. Now Grand Portage got Chippewa City back.
For National Native News, I'm Barbara Jean Myers.
The Northern Cheyenne Tribe in southeastern Montana is slated to receive $52 million in federal funding to expand broadband to nearly 2,000 homes on the tribe's reservation. Aaron Bolton has more.
Funding from the infrastructure bill passed by Congress and signed by President Biden earlier this year is expected to connect 1,700 homes in the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation to high-speed internet. According to a Broadband Now report, a little over half of reservation residents have access to high-speed internet, but none of the available services are considered affordable for low-income people. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes and the Blackfeet Nation were both awarded nearly $75 million in grants through the same Internet for All initiative earlier this year. Roughly $3 billion of federal funding has been set aside to help tribes across the country improve broadband access. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
In Alaska's U.S. House race, Representative Mary Peltola is still on track to win. Absentee ballots counted on Friday now give her 49% of the vote. She needs more than 50% to win, a number she's expected to reach on Wednesday when second choice ballots are added to the totals under Alaska's new system of ranked choice voting. In August, Peltola was elected to serve the remainder of the late Congressman Don Young's term, which made the Yupik from Bethel the first Alaska native to serve in Congress. In the race for a full term, the Democrat is ahead of two Republicans, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin and Nick Begich. Two New Mexico pueblos, Okeewingay and Santa Clara, recently signed an agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers to restore habitat in Espanola, which is located 25 miles north of Santa Fe. The Espanola Valley Ecosystem Restoration Project is a $100 million project to restore more than 900 acres of aquatic and riparian habitats along the Rio Grande River and its tributaries. The tribes will be working with the Army Corps Albuquerque District team. The agreement is said to be the first of its kind between the Army Corps and the Pueblos, and includes a provision to greatly reduce the cost share with tribal partners. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Well, we're just a few days away from the big feast, and San Francisco is leading the way this Thanksgiving in composting food scraps, which reduces waste in the landfills, produces valuable compost, and helps fight climate change. California has a new law that requires cities to do more to help residents compost their food waste. Suzanne Potter has the details.
This Thanksgiving, you can fight climate change just by composting the food scraps from your family gathering. A study done by CalRecycle, a state agency, found that one-third of the material in our landfills is compostable. Now, a new law requires all municipalities to divert 75% of their compostable waste. So, cities are implementing curbside composting programs and distributing kitchen compost pails. Robert Reed is a spokesperson for Recology, the company that pioneered food scrap collection for composting in San Francisco back in 1996.
Cities up and down the state are letting people put their food scraps in those green bins along with sticks and leaves so we can keep these materials out of landfills and instead turn them into nutrient-rich compost that goes on to local farms.
When people throw food scraps in the garbage, they end up in a landfill, which is an airless environment, and they produce methane, making landfills one of the country's largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions. The composting program turns your banana peels, eggshells, sticks, and leaves into a nutrient-rich soil amendment that acts as a sponge to save water on the farm and feeds cover crops that sequester carbon underground. Madeline Tremblay lives at a large residential complex in San Francisco. She founded a newsletter called Trash Talk 2 years ago to promote composting.
People are smart and curious, and if you give them the information and plenty of repetitive explanation, then they really get into it and they understand the value of composting and recycling.
Composting also helps to combat the drought. CalRecycle says applying all 33.2 million tons of compost currently produced in the Golden State each year increases the amount of water held in soil by about 3.7 billion gallons. This story was produced with original reporting from Hannah Wallace for the site Reasons to be Cheerful as part of the Solutions Journalism Network. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The outdoor recreation industry added $12 billion to Washington State's economy last year. Some think the state should add more protections to the Olympic Peninsula to further aid the economy. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Outdoor recreation continues to contribute to Washington State's economy in a big way. That's according to new data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, which finds the industry added $12.3 billion to the state's economy and supported more than 114,000 jobs in 2021. Ashley Nicole Lewis is the owner of Bad Ash Fishing on the Olympic Peninsula. She says Washington State is a destination for people from across the country.
It's easy to think, oh, it's just me, but there are so many people that are loving these places that it really adds up. And this economic impact report, wow, really showed us the significance of that.
Lewis says people contribute to the economy in a number of ways, such as staying at hotels, eating at local restaurants, and stopping at gear shops. And it's not just Washington. The Bureau of Economic Analysis finds outdoor recreation, including job earnings, adds more than $860 billion to the U.S. economy. Lewis says these economic numbers underscore the importance of protecting more landscapes in Washington State. The Wild Olympics bill in Congress would add more than 126,000 acres of wilderness and 19 new wild and scenic rivers and tributaries to the Olympic Peninsula. Lewis is urging Washington State Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell to do everything they can to pass this bill by the end of the year.
By actually protecting these places, preserving them, keeping them in the condition that they are, we end up protecting our beloved places that we can go and fish, but we also contribute to the economy in a more meaningful way.
Lewis is a member of the Quinault tribe and says part of the tribe's identity on the peninsula is connected to salmon. To preserve the fish, protections are key. She also says there are other perks to going outside.
It's just good for us as humans. It's good for our mental health. It's good for our physical health. It's good to socialize with other people that are doing the same thing, and that really contributes to our overall happiness. There's so many benefits that we get as individuals from spending time in the outdoors.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
More than half of infectious diseases may be aggravated by climate change. Warmer temperatures, changes in precipitation, and extreme weather can all shift the distribution and risk of disease, according to researchers. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Malaria, E. coli, cholera. Humans are vulnerable to a wide range of infectious diseases. A recent study looked at 375 diseases known to have impacted people, and it found that more than half can be aggravated by hazards affected by global warming.
Over 58% of the diseases can be affected by climatic changes.
Camilo Mora of the University of Hawaii reviewed tens of thousands of scientific papers to identify cases in which heat waves, floods, droughts, and other climate hazards have made diseases worse. For example, warmer temperatures and heavy rain can allow some pathogens, like West Nile virus and Vibrio, to thrive and reproduce more rapidly. Changing climate conditions can enable mosquitoes, bats, and other animals, and the pathogens they carry, to move into places closer to humans. And droughts and extreme weather can contribute to malnutrition, which reduces people's ability to fend off disease. The study shows that climate change has grave, far-reaching implications for human health.
This is something that can become at some point overwhelming for us as a species to deal with.
So Mora says to limit future harms to human health, reducing carbon pollution is urgent. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A farm in central Idaho has met the standards for a trout-safe certification. That labeling means that the farm is using practices that benefit the fish's habitat. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story.
A farm in Idaho has received the first-ever trout-safe certification from an organization that protects habitat for the fish. The Nature Conservancy Silver Creek Farm in central Idaho near...
for implementing practices that benefit the health of the aquatic and riparian systems.
Crescenti says the goal is for farmers to use the labeling in the marketplace so they can gain premiums there. The Nature Conservancy owns about 100 acres of farmland surrounding Silver Creek Preserve and leases it out to farmers. The group's been working with the farmers on implementing regenerative agriculture practices. Crescenti says some of the regenerative practices include no-till farming, where a second crop is planted directly into the first crop without disturbing the soil, and planting cover crops. He says they use other methods, too.
Increasing the biodiversity of that land, so looking at different crops that we can grow, using mixes within our cover crops, and that just increases the overall health of the soil and reduces the need for additional fertilizers over time.
Crescenti says salmon and trout are emblems of Idaho, but they're under increasing threat from the changing climate, which has brought longer droughts and less snowpacks.
As those symbols of the state, it's really important not just to the health of the species themselves, but also to the economy. Idaho has a very large tourism economy, and a lot of that is within the hunting and fishing arenas.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 21st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage and appreciate your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. We would really appreciate it if you would like to become a member, and here's how you do it. Support our programming by going to kboo.fm/give, or you can just text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio. Have a great night. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio. I'm your host, Michael Gaskill. Today's episode is part of an ongoing semi-monthly series I'm putting together on threatened, mature, and old-growth forests in the United States. Mature and old-growth forests are vital resources for things like carbon sequestration, biodiversity resilience, watershed protection, air purification, and so much more. Some studies show that old growth counts for as little as 7% of our remaining forest lands, yet mature and old growth forests, which by definition take generations to regenerate, are being logged right now. Literally, if you're listening to this during daylight hours, these superheroes of our natural world are on the chopping block in many places. And it's not just about the trees, it's about the entire ecosystem that they anchor. That's why the Coast Range Association is proud to be part of the Climate Forest Campaign. Over the next few months, every couple episodes or so, I'll be profiling a different threatened forest and some of the organizations working to protect them. And these episodes are going to be standalone, but I suggest checking out episode 45 with Lauren Anderson to get a good overview of the Climate Forest Campaign. You can find that and all episodes of Coast Range Radio wherever you get your podcasts or at coastrange.org. Speaking of our website, a quick note.